Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast. I'm Evan Schwartztrauber. On today's show, mobile money in Africa. As cell phone ownership in Africa has risen dramatically over the last decade, we're seeing more mobile financial resources, and they're transforming the continent. Joining me to discuss this is Scott Burns, a PhD dissertation fellow at Mercatus, a research center based at George Mason University. Scott, thanks for joining the show.
Well, thank you for having me on, Evan.
And I would like to point out that Scott was a fan of the show and reached out to me to be on the show, and here he is. So listeners, if you're a fan of the show and you have something to say, do not hesitate to reach out because it helps me to hear from you. But let's talk about mobile money in Africa. So you got a piece in Alt-M, we linked to it in the show notes of today's show, called The Mobile Money Revolution in Africa. We talked a bit with your colleague Caleb Watney from Mercatus about Bitcoin in Africa, but give us a sense of just how much the cell phone landscape in Africa has changed over the last decade and why that's so important for having financial resources on your cell phone.
Yeah, so that's one of the most fascinating stories, I think, right now going on in economic developments in the world is just how fast cell phones have proliferated across the African continent and throughout the developing world. So if you go back in time to the early 2000s even, cell phones were hardly ever seen in Africa. The penetration rate for cell phones was 1 or 2%, just vanishingly small compared to the developed world. But what you saw around the early 2000s is that a lot of these African countries that had for so long these telecom monopolies that were very ineffective, very much under the control of the reigning government, and just highly inefficient, they were eroded away. A lot of the countries actually privatized the telecom industry. They allowed foreign companies to come in and invest. And so what you saw over the next decade or so was just a huge proliferation of cell phones in the continent. And so this was especially prominent in the countries that liberalized more quickly, like Kenya and Tanzania, where now, instead of seeing only 1 or 2% of the population having access to cell phones, the number's more like about 100% of the adult population.
Online banking in the United States, we generally associate it with long-established financial institutions that have functioned prior to the advent of the internet and then just use the internet as a supplement.
Right.
So if you're an 80-year-old woman, let's say, or man who does not want to use the internet to bank, you can still do all those things offline, and the app is just a supplement. But when we're talking about mobile money in Africa, we're not necessarily just talking about, I have a bank account and then I have an app for my bank account. It's quite different. And you use the example of M-P-E-S-A. Is that M-Pesa for short? Mm-hmm. It's run by Safaricom. That's Kenya's dominant mobile network operator, wireless carrier.
That's right.
Tell us about M-Pesa and how is that different than me using my Bank of America app to pay a credit card bill?
So M-Pesa is a service that enables users to send and receive payments and store money in their mobile wallets and pay for goods and services at many retail shops in Kenya. And they can send money back home to their friends and family throughout the country. They can also deposit cash and withdraw cash from agents around the countries. So basically what M-Pesa is, and one of the big differences with the type of online banking that you talked about just a second ago that we enjoy here in the United States, is that most people in Kenya and then in Africa in general don't have access to bank accounts. So what makes M-Pesa unique is that it's offered through not a bank necessarily, but through the mobile network operator, the MNO, in this case, Safaricom, which has the largest market share in the country of Kenya.
So this would be the equivalent of, let's say, T-Mobile or Verizon providing you with a banking software. This is not...
That's exactly right.
So this is... And why in Africa does it make sense for a telecom to be the one that provides financial tools other than, say, the government or banks or global companies? I mean, why is it the Kenya phone carrier that's offering the financial services? It's counterintuitive.
So probably the best explanation for that is simply that they have a lot more of the public's trust than a lot of the banks in the banking sector in these countries. So when you look at many African countries, not just Kenya, but dozens of examples across sub-Saharan Africa, the banking system is heavily regulated and heavily under state control. So many of the largest banks in these countries are still at least partially owned by the government itself. People don't have faith in the banking institutions, but because these telecom companies ever since the early 2000s have been liberalized and privatized, and you've had reputable foreign companies come in like Vodafone, who's the parent company of Safaricom that have a lot of brand name capital, people have more faith in those institutions.
And so there is still some type of government involvement in this process because You mentioned that you can send payments, you can store money, you can pay for things and deposit or withdraw cash from licensed agents. So what is a licensed agent, and is the government playing a role there that is benefit, that it's a benefit rather than just the tight regulation we talked about with banks that prevents low-income Africans from getting access to finances?
Well, you're right that there is still some active role for governments in these technologies in terms of the role they actually play. But what's interesting, especially when we talk about agent banking, this allowing people to not necessarily open a bank account through a formal bank, to walk into an actual bank branch, but rather to go to what essentially in a lot of these villages are just small huts where they can, you know, open up a Safaricom account and transfer money to their friends and family and do all these things very cheaply without being subjected to all this very thick regulations that would otherwise be applied to them if they tried to open a formal bank account.
So it's easy to get a license? I mean, can
for the agents, yeah, that's one of the key factors, that it's incredibly easy. The government's lowered the barriers to entry into agent banking significantly because in many cases, either they saw the promise of mobile banking, and in Kenya, this was kind of the case. They realized they had a huge problem of financial exclusion, and so they decided to deregulate the financial industry pretty significantly by allowing agents to come in. The other kind of influence for the rise of mobile banking in other countries has been that in the same way that Uber and Lyft and apps like these weren't necessarily formally approved before they entered into cities, they just kind of launched and people loved them. The same thing kind of happened with agent banking and with mobile money. In a lot of instances, the technology was kind of released to the public, and by the time it took off and by the time politicians, if they wanted to regulate it, could try to respond and, you know, stifle it and put it out of existence, they were going to face too much backlash from the population because it was so beloved in those areas.
Well, yeah, you've got two problems there. You've got the Uber problem, as you describe, where you show up and you create a huge fan base, also known as your customers, that can then be activated for political purposes like they did in New York City to beat back a cap.
Right.
You've also got a situation, I guess, in Kenya where the app was able to launch without necessarily formal approval. It was very much ask for forgiveness, not permission, right?
Right.
It's easier to ask for forgiveness, not permission. And then not only do you have the public pressure from people liking something like M-Pesa, but then you have potential economic calamity by getting rid of it. Because
exactly.
In developing countries, maybe like Kenya or other countries, when something like this takes off, there are probably so many small, tiny businesses that people started just immediately based on this, and there might have been very immediate economic benefits. And for the government to get rid of it would probably be very bad, even if you don't care what the people think, because it might cause problems. Now, why is Kenya a good environment for something like this? I mean, Africa's a very diverse continent. You got like something like over 50 countries. Why did Kenya take off when it comes to mobile banking?
So I think there's two factors that we can point to that made it a ripe environment for this new technology. One of them is simply that Kenya, like many other African countries, had very low rates of financial inclusion. So they had literally millions of adults in the population who never had opened a bank account in their lives.
It's just much cash less, society, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Much less stepped foot inside of a bank. And so there was kind of a latent demand to provide these services because people would, obviously, all things equal, they would love to be able to open up a bank account where they can earn interest on their savings, save for the future, access credit. But if there's no bank within a day's walk of your village, the transactions costs are simply too high. And from a bank standpoint, if you look at things from the supply side instead of the demand side, it's not economically feasible in a lot of cases for banks to provide these services because, frankly, it costs a lot of money to set up a branch in the middle of nowhere. And if you set up a bank branch in a village in Kenya, the chances are the population there is not going to have enough savings and wealth anyway to actually keep that bank afloat.
Yeah, and when you're talking about the intersection of tech policy and financial policy, the tech sector is often, in many countries, regulated much less than the financial sector because the financial sector is much older. It's more established. There's been lobbying. There's been favors. There's been deals that have been struck. So even if Kenya wanted to open up and be more traditional with its banking system, that'd probably be tough. Whereas in this case, you've already got people owning cell phones. We talked in a previous episode called The Internet in Africa with Evelyn Smith from AEI about how prominent cell phones are in Africa, partly because they're really cheap Android smartphones that can be bought for little to nothing. And then things like zero rating and subsidized data help people access the services. But I mean, it would be tough for Kenya to pivot that way and this is a low transaction cost. All you have to do is kind of just let it happen and not crack down.
Exactly. And so that's really kind of the second factor that I'd point to for being why Kenya was such a ripe environment was that to some extent, you have to give the regulators some credit. They realized they had this massive problem of financial exclusion and that the status quo was not working. The heavily regulated formal financial system was not economically able to branch out to these people who had been financially excluded, especially people outside of big cities. And so they were kind of the first country, to their credit, who said, we need to ease up these regulations. We need to establish a lighter touch regulatory environment. That's one of the phrases you see a lot in their testimonies. They wanted to have a light touch regulatory approach where they weren't stifling new innovations and ways of accessing the poor. And so in many ways, I think this dovetails with something that I believe a previous guest on your show has talked about. They created an environment of permissionless innovation in a sense. They helped welcome new tech startups and new, more efficient technologies that could come in and provide these services more cheaply than the banking system, which, you know, we kind of touched on this earlier, but the banking system had always been very heavily regulated in countries like Kenya. And so expecting this, you know, a new innovative business model to emerge out of this kind of rigid older system was very unlikely. And I think a lot of people in Kenya recognized that. And so to their credit, they said, we can't come up with these solutions necessarily from the top down. We might not be able to come up with a perfect solution, you know, that's emanating from a government plan or from the existing banking sector. We need to create an enabling environment for these more bottom-up solutions and allow entrepreneurs to come in and solve the problem.
So the Kenyan government gave this its implicit blessing, but of course there were probably folks in Kenya, stakeholders, others who did not want this to happen. I mean, any time a new technology arises and people adopt it en masse, you're going to see a backlash. In the United States context, we often see that with Uber versus taxi cartels. In this case, you could imagine there would be several stakeholders that wouldn't want a mobile money revolution in Africa. The banks, the traditional financial institutions, as ineffective as they are, probably have some way of making money. They operate in maybe a very corrupt, regulated environment, but they still operate. And they probably see this very unfavorably because they've had to comply with all sorts of regulations and the apps do not. So that's one potential. Then there's also just the government losing control, you know, people being more permissionless innovation, you know, repressive regimes. And I'm not sure about Kenya, but maybe other countries in Africa, they want to control the financial system, and something like Bitcoin and M-Pesa takes control away. So let's start with the first stakeholder. What did the banks in Kenya have to say about this?
So very predictably, the bank's initial response was, look, this is a form of competition that we might not be able to keep up with. It became, you know, M-Pesa took off within the first year. They had well over a million customers. So this was something that had a takeoff rate that no bank had seen in terms of its ability to expand services to the poor population. So unsurprisingly, one of the first things they said when they lobbied the government was, look, we need to act on behalf of consumer protection because this new startup, we don't really know if it's safe or reliable for customers. It hasn't been properly vetted in terms of it's only been around for a few months. So for all we know, these customers are going to lose all their money. There's going to be a hacker that comes in, or this might be used. So this is a very common excuse that's used. Even today, terrorists are going to use this. Digital money, you know, it'll be easier for terrorists to access funds from all around the world using this. And so banks stepped in and basically said, we want you to regulate this essentially out of existence, much in the way that taxi unions got together when Uber would come into a town and they would try very heavily to have Uber be forced to comply with the same set of regulations that they were being forced to comply with. So just to give you a quick anecdote from Kenya, one of the interesting things that happened back in 2007, 2008, and this is back when M-Pesa was first being launched, was that the government went ahead and it did a deep investigation to see if these claims were accurate. And it completely backfired on the banks because what they in fact found was that not only was M-Pesa not too subject to these dangers, the consumer protection dangers that the banks had pointed out, that it was in fact much more safe and reliable than the banking services that were provided by formal banks. So it really backfired on them.
Yeah, because in the United States, I think most people are comfortable with online banking. You know, when there is a problem, the bank will go to bat for you or your credit card company will try to help you out. There's a strong customer service element there. And when we talk about cybersecurity, I'm not an expert, but my guests and others have told me that banking is one of the better you know, forms of cybersecurity, that online banking is fairly well secured. And I guess right. that would be an obvious question that the government of Kenya would want to know is how secure is M-Pesa? But judging by the study that the banks actually asked for, which is kind of ironic, it came back in a very bad way for the banks and a good way for M-Pesa.
Exactly. And again, one of the kind of paradoxes here is that it's actually a lot more safe from the government standpoint to monitor transactions digitally, because there's actually kind of a paper trail that way. The most common form, if you want to pursue black market activities, or if you're a terrorist organization and you want to raise revenue, the most common way to do that and the safest for them in terms of anonymity is not necessarily M-Pesa or something like Bitcoin even. It's currency. It's cash. That's right. Government-issued cash. And that was kind of the second vested interest group that we talked about a second ago that I was going to reference real quick, is that even the government, some elements of it at least, were very suspicious about the rise of M-Pesa, because when you think about it, if people are using digital currency, and I should just state to clarify very quickly that this is not like Bitcoin. It's not a completely separate currency. It's more like your Venmo account or your online banking account. It's a claim to Kenyan shillings in this case,
yeah,
if you live
in
Kenyan. It's a form of payment system and online banking.
Yeah, M-Pesa is the Kenyan currency, whereas in that episode we did with Caleb, we were talking about using Bitcoin instead of the currency of Zimbabwe, because Zimbabwe has some challenges with inflation that I'm guessing Kenya does not necessarily have.
Right.
Their problem is more institutions. We do not have functioning banks, so people need to use M-Pesa.
But it's still a threat, even if you're still using, in Kenya's case, shillings as the money that ultimately that's what you redeem M-Pesa for. You still get shillings in return for everything. It's still a threat to the government's currency monopoly, because if more people don't have to hold on to Kenyan shillings, on the cash itself, it's actually cutting into what economists call seniorage, the amount of revenue that governments can raise basically from being the monopoly provider of currency, from issuing paper money. If people hold less paper money, the government has to, unless it wants inflation to soar out of control, it's going to have to curtail the supply of that, which means, in effect, they can't get banks and other organizations to buy as much of their debt. They have to cut the currency supply. That's going to reduce their seniorage. So yeah, there was a pretty big pushback from some elements of the Kenyan government saying, hey, we rely very heavily on these seniorage revenues that we get because so many people are stuck holding our currency. This new technology is going to cut into that.
Yeah, mobile money is a way to get outside of the systems that have plagued people for so long in countries in Africa, like corruption, like Greece payments, like telecom monopolies. And there's a reason that M-Pesa took off in Kenya and not in Ethiopia. I talked with Evelyn Smith about how Kenya deregulated its telecom sector, whereas Ethiopia has a complete monopoly and it's completely hopeless. So do you see this model spreading throughout the continent? And what are some of the benefits, you know, real hard benefits of this? I mean, there's obviously the convenience, and I never had a bank and now I do, but are we seeing that countries that have systems like this are doing better than others?
So first off, the empirical evidence is extremely promising about this technology spreading outside of a place, even like Kenya. So what we see today is that there's over 400 million accounts around the world in more than 93 countries. So this is no longer just a Kenyan phenomenon or even a sub-Saharan African phenomenon. It is true that the best success stories still take place in sub-Saharan Africa because cell phone penetration rates are so high, and because many of the governments, you know, a lot of the surrounding governments around Kenya, when people started to see the success that was going on in Kenya, they started to emulate the good policies that were in place in Kenya and tried to reduce regulations and create a more enabling environment. So it's true that Kenya kind of served as ground zero, and sub-Saharan Africa still represents the vast majority of where we see successful mobile money operations. But now it's taking over all over in Latin America. You see new operations that have been launched in Southeast Asia, in South America. So there's just some great examples of how this technology has exploded on a global scene. And then is it okay if I get to your second point too about what are some of the broader implications?
Absolutely.
So economists do a lot of, there's been great research done in the past 50 years, especially by economists, on the link between financial development and economic development. And before the past 50 years or so, it was very heavily debated within economics. Does finance actually contribute to economic development? That seems kind of funny now, but it seemed very abstract to economists. Okay, banks kind of, you know, they play these roles. They help facilitate payments. They accept savings and stuff. But do banks really make a difference in making an economy rich or not?
Yeah. And then there's always that impression that they're just making shit up, that they don't actually create value. I mean, you know, like a manufacturer or a farmer looks at a bank and goes, what the hell is a derivative? Are you actually doing anything, or are you just making money out of money? So there is that perception that all they do is push buttons and the little guy gets screwed.
Yeah. What's the old line? The 3-6-3 rule, the borrow at 3%, lend at 6%, play golf at 3. That kind of perception of bankers is they don't really do anything that actually helps. They just kind of shuffle money around and, you know, make money off of other people's hard-earned income. But what these economists have shown is that banks actually do. Having a well-functioning financial system plays a very critical role in bringing countries out of poverty and into a developed state. In fact, it's one of the most important things that an economy can have, that less developed countries can have to escape this poverty trap, is a well-developed financial system. Because one thing that just about every economist agrees on is that savings play an important role. You need to have the ability to channel your society's savings into productive investments. And what do banks do, essentially? They stand at that intersection of savings and investments. If you have reliable banks and you have a high savings rate in the country, so people are saving money with banks, it's going to be a lot easier for those private banks to lend money out for productive purposes to commercial ventures, to hopefully reliable investors. And that's what really sparks this process of economic development. And that's what things like M-Pesa are contributing to, because even though I've kind of portrayed it so far as being, in some sense, a lower cost alternative to the formal banking system, what's happened ever since, and this is to me is the most exciting development, is that once banks realize, okay, this technology is here to stay, the people love it, they started to partner with companies like Safaricom and other MNOs who offered mobile money services. So now you don't just, if you have an M-Pesa account, it's not just that you have a payment platform that you can use through your cell phone. Now you can partner that. You can link that account to a bank account, because many banks in Africa have partnered with Safaricom and these other companies. So now you actually have a savings account. You can access credit.
Things that in theory the app was limited to because it wasn't a bank. Now exactly. The marriage of the traditional banking system and the app gives you the convenience. It gives you the Venmo-like aspects, but it also gives you something like a small business loan.
Exactly.
And the African continent, of course, has so many challenges in the developing world, but cell phones and things like mobile money have been a real bright spot. And this is largely good news that we're discussing today. So it's great to talk about it. We're going to leave it there. My guest has been Scott Burns, a PhD dissertation fellow at Mercatus, which is a research center at George Mason University. Scott, thanks for joining the show, and glad to see you're a fan. And now you've been able to come on the show.
That's right. Well, thank you again for having me, Evan.
Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. Let us know what you think of the episode. Email us at media@techfreedom.org with ideas for topics and guests. You can pull a Scott and email me and ask to be on the show yourself. Find this podcast in the iTunes store or on your favorite podcast app, or you can please leave us a review, because it will help others find the show. Thanks for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.